I'd like to call this meeting of House Transportation Committee to order. It is currently 1:04 p.m. on Thursday, March 19th, and we're in room 124. Members present include Representative St. Clair, Representative Nelson, Representative Stutes, Representative Mina, Representative McCabe, Co-Chair Eichheit, and myself, Co-Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phones. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing our committee today, as well as our committee aides Griffin Sukeo from my office and Meredith Trainer from my co-chair's office. On today's agenda, we are first doing a slight bit of housekeeping to move the fiscal note that should have accompanied House Joint Resolution 42 from our previous hearing. And then we will, after that, have a presentation from Department of Transportation on the pre-construction division of the DOT. So I'll start with Co-Chair Eichheit, if I could have a motion on the fiscal note for HJR 42.
I move fiscal note identifier HJR 42LEGSESS03172026 from committee.
Hearing no objection, the fiscal note for HJR 42 has passed the committee. And at this time, thank you all for that. I would like to invite our presenter to the dais. It sounds like we have Lauren Little here today, the chief engineer at DOT and Public Facilities, and Al Beck, our Northern Region pre-construction chief, are available. Thank you both for being in Juneau and for joining us. And if you'd like to go ahead and put yourselves on the record and start the presentation.
Yes, thank you very much. For the record, Lauren Little, Alaska DOT and PF Chief Engineer and Acting Northern Region Director.
For the record, Al Beck, Northern Region Pre-Construction Engineer with the Department of Transportation Public Facilities.
Great, thank you.
For the record, Lauren Little. So just kind of high level, we weren't entirely sure what exactly folks wanted to hear about specifically, but this sort of is a graphic kind of highlighting, you know, my mind goes back to School Rocks and the I'm Just a Bill on Capitol Hill. This is kind of our version of that, right? We start with an idea in planning, and that becomes a need. And then once the planning group sort of collects those needs, keeps track of them, and at some point they go from being a need to being something needed enough that we're going to put money to it and we're going to turn it into a project. And then once it becomes a project, the first step that we have to do is the environmental analysis and complete the environmental review, ending in an environmental document. On the Federal Highway side, you know, that would be or FAA or the FTA. Those are NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act documents. On the state side, we kind of just have a checklist, but it's all generally the same categories that we're looking at. once we're done with that NEPA stage of the project, we move into detailed design. And so under the environmental stage, we're going to have, you know, roughly, depending on the project, a 10 to 30% level of design. So we're going to have a decent idea of footprint, you know, impacts. That footprint level of detail may be very different for, say, a Safer Seward Highway project than, you know, a simple resurfacing project. But really all we're doing design-wise in that stage is determining enough information to have a good handle on cost and impacts. Then we move into detailed design, and so this is where we really start engineering out all the details and developing those plan specifications and cost estimates that are needed to bid the project for construction. If we have a project that's going to need a new right-of-way to complete, we'll get that project footprint dialed in, and then we'll hand that off to our right-of-way engineering group to develop right-of-way plans and ultimately move forward with the right-of-way acquisition process, which includes, of course, that definition of the property interest needed, an appraisal of that property interest, then a review of that appraisal to make sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed before we actually make a property owner offer. And then through that. Property owners can counteroffer, and we sort of work through that. I hate to call it negotiations. We don't negotiate with property owners, but we are able to receive counteroffers and work through the details of those and accept those counteroffers to ultimately secure that property interest. Once we have all the necessary property interests, any utility relocation agreements that need to be made, and that complete engineer-stamped plan specification and cost estimate, then we can bid that project and move forward to build it. And then at the completion of that, we hand over what is hopefully a nice, well-built piece of infrastructure to our maintenance folks, and they proceed to maintain it. So I'll pause there if there's questions.
Great. We have a question from Representative Stutes.
Thank you. You don't negotiate with property owners? I'm not sure how that fits into the – how do you attain the property, or did I miss something in the translation there?
Yeah, through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, what I mean there is so in a typical, you know, you want to go buy a home, you're gonna make an offer, and then the homeowner, the current homeowner, may counter, right? They may say, you know, well, or they may not counter. They may simply say, that's not good enough, make another offer, and there's this negotiation. Under the Uniform Act, we don't negotiate with property owners. So they can come with a counteroffer. They can say, we think you appraised our land wrong. We don't agree that we think you have more impact, whatever the case may be. We can accept that. We can have a conversation around it, but we can't say, okay, well, sure, you said $10 a square foot, but how about $9?
Gotcha.
That's what I mean by not negotiating.
Appreciate that. And pardon me, Madam Chair, that was through the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Rules Chair. We'll go down to Co-Chair Eisheis.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, so this graphic is really nice versus just having text. I can see the flow. I love seeing that. It starts with planning as a former planner myself. But it says general project development process. So that kind of indicates that you sometimes don't use this. So when don't you use this process?
Yeah, through the co-chair to co-chair Eisheid. This is just high level. We've got another slide coming that has more granular detail, particularly for that detailed design side. So when I say general project development process, I'm saying we follow this process for every project, this general process, but there's a lot of details within each of those, you know, circles that I didn't, you know, give you a detailed bullet by bullet, you know, here's everything we do under environmental, here's everything we do in the right-of-way stage. So that's what I mean by general.
Okay. Follow up. So it starts in the upper left and it goes around clockwise. So just, you know, as I see, you got planning, environmental review, design, land acquisition, construction, and maintenance. That makes sense to me. But these are consecutive functions, not concurrent. Am I correct on that? I think you have to get the land before you do the construction, or of course it's a road. So do you actually get all the land before you do the construction just because you need the right of way? And and is it consecutive concurrent? Mm-hmm. I think. Yeah. Please.
Yes, through the co-chair. Co-chair Eisheid, if you'll humor me, our next slide actually will show the waterfall and then the things that do go in parallel. In general, it is this flow. There are some, you can be doing design and property acquisition concurrently. If you have a long linear project, like say the Safer Seward Highway, you could have sufficient property interest. Actually, University Avenue in Fairbanks is maybe a better example. We got the right-of-way acquisition for, say, Geist Road to Airport Way, and so we can go do that build-out, certify that piece, and get that in construction while we're still negotiating Airport Way to the Mitchell Expressway, for example. So there's some things we can do in parallel, and there's some things, particularly with the Federal Highways process, that are very much waterfall. One thing has to happen before the next thing.
Follow-up, final one. So, you know, we talk about some projects. You mentioned the Safer Seward. I'm familiar with that. You mentioned the Fairbanks project that I'm not familiar with. We've recently talked about Cascade Point quite a bit in this committee. Is this a process that is or was being used for Cascade Point sequential like this?
Through the co-chair, Co-Chair Eisheid, This is the general project development process in terms of there's a need, we have environmental analysis, we have detailed design. That would be followed for any project. Every project details can vary, and as I mentioned, the funding source sometimes dictates what things can be allowed to happen in parallel. So in a state model, for example, a state-funded model, we would not necessarily have to wait for that final environmental decision to be doing more advanced design to even begin some of the property acquisition stages. When you move into the federal highway model, it becomes much more rigid. So I don't know the details of Cascade Point. I'm a Fairbanks kid, so that's, I can tell you about University Avenue all day long, but I don't have any further detail for you on Cascade Point.
Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Very quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, under which one of these parts of the planning process or development process does public comment fall?
Yeah, through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, that's a great question. In a typical project, in a robust project, like we'll take the Safer Sewer, that public involvement will be throughout the life of that project, right? So there's usually a very robust effort in the environmental stage where we're working out the broader purpose and need, what alternatives might meet the purpose and need. But we typically also, particularly for projects that may have a long lifespan to get to that construction piece, we'll have additional outreach over the life of the project. That may take different forms. It may become, newsletter updates, website updates. But in general, the public involvement process is through the life of the project. Even before we go to construction, Fairbanks Old Nenana Highway, we had open houses at every design milestone as well as before construction to introduce them to the contractor and the schedule and all that. So that's fairly common for us to have over the life.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah, there's a complete public process in the STIP as well, right? So if this is a STIP project, you have a pretty much an ongoing public comment process. I think Commissioner Anderson spends a big chunk of time reading all of those, if I'm not mistaken, right? Yeah.
Okay. we can go ahead and continue the presentation.
So this slide this flowchart is actually directly from our highway pre-construction manual. And so the point of this is simply to show that there is quite a bit of process and milestones in our project development process. So this is all after receiving our authority to proceed through final PS&E is what this flowchart is based on. Some of these activities, you'll notice the double asterisk. These are activities that we can begin working on while we're still in the environmental stage, right? You need to know what your right-of-way is, know what your right-of-way impact is going to be. You need to know what utilities are out there and what sort of footprint they may need. So a lot of this stuff is at least the prelim work is being done during the environmental stage. Once we've completed an environmental document, then we seek authority to proceed through final PS&E from Federal Highways, and that allows us to do the more detailed engineering design. And so you see that's where you see, as legislators, you guys typically get a copy of a project design study report in your district when it's completed. So that's sort of the first milestone that we have after that authority to proceed through final plan specs and estimate is a document summarizing the design standards we're following, any alternatives we've evaluated, and that constitutes what we call design approval. Design approval unlocks the ability to seek FHWA funding for authority to appraise and acquire. So that's another, Federal Highways has to bless that specific ATP for us to begin doing appraisals and acquisitions. So we need a design study report and we need preliminary right-of-way plans so that we're telling Federal Highways this is the scope of what this phase is going to entail. Once we receive that authority to proceed to appraise and acquire, then we can kick off that right-of-way process in earnest. We can't acquire the property until we have that. There are some exceptions to that. If you have a project with a complete acquisition of a property, those can proceed a little bit more, a little bit earlier. So after the environmental document is done, you can actually begin to acquire those, what we call total acquisitions. Most acquisitions we do are strip, you know, they're partials. So we don't do that a lot, but we did the University Avenue project I mentioned was one where we did have some total partial acquisitions due to the magnitude of the project. And then the utility relocation side, again, we can be developing relocation plans, utility agreements with our utility partners before they actually physically do work on relocating the utility. We have to seek Federal Highways authority to proceed through utility relocations, and that's what we call a phase seven, and that allows for utility relocation work to begin. We can do some utility relocation work actually happens in the construction contract in what we call the phase four. So the phase seven, a lot of times that's just utility inspection time on, you know, the moved water line or sewer line, for example, or it could be the utility company themselves. The communications and electric utilities typically have agreements and their own contractors to do the work, and so they're doing all of that work under these phase seven utility relocation agreements. And then on the project development side, so we've got, you know, the right-of-way off to one side and the utility off to one side, and they're kind of running concurrent with design. Then we've also got the next big milestone is the plan specs and estimate review, so the 95% review. Depending on the size and scale of the project, you might do additional reviews before your 95% review. Once that step's complete, then we move that project towards that final plan specs and estimates. We seek out our disadvantaged business enterprise and on-the-job training goals. These are federal aid programs. Once we have a final plan specs and estimates, we have all of the right-of-way acquired, and we have agreements in place for utility relocations. We do what's called a project certification. If you've paid attention to any of the tentative advertising schedule meetings, you'll hear this project certification, this cert set. This is a required step in the Code of Federal Regulations that we certify that we have the property interests we need, that we've made all the arrangements. And at that point, we can seek funding for authority to construction. And once we get that authority to proceed to construction, then we can advertise the project for bids and carry on to that construction step. And I'll pause there for questions on the federal highway process, and then I'll let Al touch a little bit on what's different in the FAA world.
Great. Thank you. We have a question from Co-Chair Eichert.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, I had a question about the middle thing. I actually have two questions, so I'll just say one at a time. The first one is the local review, and it says optional. And so my question I'd written earlier is, why optional? And so, and also related to that particular bullet is, it says local review, and right away I think of metropolitan planning organizations. So can you tell us what local review means in places where there's MPOs and places there's not, and then why it's optional, and then I'll have a follow-up question.
Yes, through the co-chair, Co-Chair Eichheit. So there's a lot of additional steps in, say, a municipality that has planning authority, right? So there's state statute around receiving local planning approval. We typically do that with the design study report. So this flowchart doesn't reflect every single thing we do on a project. The local review is it's optional because not all projects. It's sort of a special before you've even gotten to PS&E. You're going out. But it's a formal review in the Highway Pre-Construction Manual as opposed to our design study reports. Even our environmental stage, we have agency scoping where we do seek out, like if I have a project in the Fairbanks North Shore Borough, they're getting an agency scoping letter. You know, here's the project coming. We'll work that project through the local planning approval process once we have that design study report. So it's not that there isn't a local component to all projects that have a local component. It's just this is a formal review step that some jurisdictions want to see, and so we do it there. Others, we have other places that we do that. We also do distribute our PS&E reviews. Like if we're doing a project for the City of Fairbanks, they'll get a copy of the PS&E review. And so we do get that local input throughout those milestone steps.
Follow up.
Follow up.
So thank you for that. That that activated a lot of my prior learning, because I remember when I was a planner for the Mat-Su Borough, agencies, federal and state, would reach out to the borough for comments. Sometimes I was assigned to make those draft comments, so that makes sense. My final question is the bullet below that, plans in hand review. Again, it says optional, but I assume if you have a plan that is pertinent to a specific project, what do you do if there is an earlier plan that there's an earlier plan and then an updated plan? Which plan do you use? You know, essentially two essential plans, you know, like land use planning. You know, the Mat-Su Borough has a comprehensive plan. They're actually working on an update right now. I think they're almost done, which means the old land use plan will be superseded by a updated one because, you know, every 20 years, things change. So in the case of where you have two plans, but one is updated, essentially the same, which plan do you use in your work?
Yes, through the co-chair, Co-Chair Eichscheid. That is actually handled in the environmental document. So the environmental document is where we confirm consistency with local land use transportation plans, as well as in the terms of a comprehensive plan in a borough or a municipality. That would be the local planning approval process, would be another check on that. So you see the single asterisks for environmental document reevaluation required. There's stage gates in these things. So, like, before we seek authority to proceed to construction, we have to do a reeval of the document, make sure everything's still valid, things haven't changed. Same with the authority to appraise and acquire, as well as there's time thresholds, and I don't remember them off the top of my head, that we have to reevaluate those documents if so much time has gone by as well. So that's where we would capture those consistency with local plans, transportation, land use, comprehensive, et cetera. When we're talking plans in hand review, these are plans, specs, and estimates reviews. So these are, I've got, you know, lines on paper, method of measurement, basis of payment, and so it's a more technical review in that line there, as opposed to, you know, we still always have all of those external factors feeding into, but usually the environmental document captures a lot of those aspects.
Thank you.
And we also have a question from Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My question is just in general, you know, the Federal Highway Administration that you talked about, there's different processes if it's a federal project versus a state. And I could, you know, in general, I understand that versus like a federal highway. But is there any other delineation or kind of in general, when is it considered, from your perspective, a federal project and a state? And is there ever a time where a project overlaps?
Yes, to the co-chair, Representative Nelson. Typically, there's two scenarios that we run into. There's a project that was started with state funds that was always intended to be fully state funded, and for whatever reason, we did this presentation for Senate Transportation a couple weeks ago about federalizing projects. So, like the Wendell Avenue Bridge was one of our examples. For whatever reason, when the time came to construct, we didn't have sufficient state money left for construction, so we said, this is a federally eligible project. We'll build it with federal funds. And so we have to go update our environmental because we had a state environmental. So now we have to bring it into NEPA compliance, which we try not to stray too far between the different processes, right? But we would update that environmental and seek that authority to proceed through construction with the Federal Highway Administration. And at that point, all the federal strings would apply, but they would only apply from the date that we federalized it forward. Another common thing, so there's several bridge replacements going on in the state right now where we started them with state funds. We had a appropriation specific to bridges from the legislature, and so we used those state funds to start these bridges. We knew all along we were going to use federal money for construction, and so we assigned them federal internal tracking numbers. We proceeded with them entirely in the federal process. There are some, until you actually put the federal money on it, you do have some flexibility to do some of these things concurrent because you are still fully state funded. But as soon as that federal money is on, all of those stage gates are in play, and all of those requirements are in play. And so you want to make sure, you know, if you know you're going to federalize it, for example, you're going to follow the federal requirements for right-of-way acquisition, which don't differ a lot, but there's some different dollar value thresholds where we can do a waiver valuation for a slightly higher amount under a state acquisition as opposed to a federal. In general, our processes are not that different between state and federal, other than the ability to do a lot more concurrent with state money until we federalized it. That's the main difference there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have a question, Representative McCabe?
Just thinking, not bad. 10 minutes per slide. That's great.
Well, you're in the best committee in the world, so
I know.
You got time. Feel free to continue. Thank you.
For the record, Al Beck. So the primary difference here between Federal Highway Administration and to the FAA design project is we are ending up designing on the state dollar. So we start our project, and we call it a crude unbuild. So there's a portion of our state budget where we're designing these projects on. And so the ATP level at the very first portion of it, the authority to proceed doesn't really exist in the pattern of developing and delivering an aviation project. And so the project is started through an aviation advisory board. It's the APEB panel, and it will nominate. The regions will nominate a project, and it'll go there for scoring. And there's a group, a body that scores the projects. And then when it's determined it's going to fit in the funding program for the FAA allotment to the state, we'll begin a project to try and meet those dates. And so from day one, we can design the project, we can work on the environmental, all the public involvement associated with those projects, we can look at the constraints that we're going to have for right-of-way at day one. So there's no necessary order to delivering the project. You go back to that general slide, is you still follow the general process because you have to have the idea, you have to have the planning, you got to coordinate with the people out there, especially in our aviation industry. A lot of rural communities have these airports, and so we're working on the community. Where can the material come from? Is there a sufficient land for the airport boundary to accommodate those improvements? And then you start developing the project. You do a lot more design ahead of your environmental document, typically on an FAA project, because you're identifying the impacts. And then as you are nearing completion of the process, you're still doing all those other parts and pieces that Lauren mentioned about working towards having a plan set, having an estimate, and be able to certify the project. You're certifying that the environmental is complete, the right-of-way is complete, the utilities are complete, and the design was managed and designed to the aviation circulars. And every step of the way as we're working through there, even though there's no formal authority to proceed level, we are seeking authority to FAA to move forward with processes, move forward with the completion of the environmental document, because we work with them to complete the environmental document. They mail out things that they sign the environmental document. Same thing with professional service agreements. When if we have to seek additional design assistance and hire a consultant, we have to seek authority to FAA to allow us to enter into those agreements, leading all the way up to the completion of our final plan set. So we will self-certify these projects in the region, and then we will work with statewide to verify there is sufficient legislative authority. And then once we have identified there is legislative authority for the project, that gives us the ability to confirm with FAA that they allow us to advertise the project. So through written correspondence, they give us concurrence. We advertise the project, and then we open bids, and then we'll know what the dollar amount of the project is going to cost. We will know what we spent to date on the project in the design phase. We know the low bid estimate on it. We will know if we'll have to update the airport land use drawings, anything necessary for nav aids, any additional design cost post-construction. And then we have our budget, and we can go and seek our grant at that time. So then FAA will then reimburse the state for the money expended, and up to 90% of the total value of the grant. We have to complete the project and near close out the construction project to get the full last reimbursement of that 10% to get 100% reimbursement from that grant. So I skipped over quite a bit because Lauren did cover all of the steps that we follow, but we can do it out of order, let's say, on an FAA project.
We have a question from Representative Stutes.
Imagine that. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I might be mixing apples and oranges here, so forgive me if I am. But I'm listening to this, and I'm listened to Lauren say that all along you have a public process. And then last week here in this committee, we heard a bill where DOT, it didn't sound like it went through the process that you're speaking of with the area or the neighborhood that was impacted by DOT decisions. So I guess I'm a little confused. This happened to be a situation in Girdwood, and maybe you're familiar with it, maybe you're not, and again, maybe I'm mixing apples and oranges. But, thank you. Mr. Mills.
And with that, Representative Stutes, you have summoned Mr. Mills.
For the record, Andy Mills, Special Assistant and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I thought this might be a better one for me to tackle, as this is well outside the realm of our subject matter experts on this one. So through the chair to Representative Stutes, the bill and the conversation about Girdwood was a conversation about one. I think one piece of detail that was missing was we were talking about in-boundary activity versus out of boundary, and that was kind of being conflated and confused. It's one thing we should expand upon. As far as public engagement, we did note that the master plan, of course, was 20 some years old, so it was, from a community standpoint, certainly an updated master plan would be good to make sure that there's a fresh, speaking to some of the things we talked about earlier on this presentation, making sure that that is taking into account the latest, because 20 years is a pretty long time for most communities. There's a lot of other development happening at the Girdwood Airport, not just what was sort of the rationale and basis of the bill from Representative Holland. Also, anytime a leasing action is taking on an airport, and this had a couple different solicitations, those have a public process where it's put on the online public notice system and posted. And so there is that public notice piece of it. And certainly there were folks engaging with some of the folks at the area. I think what's being missed is that boundary, it was within the airport boundary itself, and some of the folks in that area, certainly if you were to look at the plats, the airport boundary was, well, I'm pretty sure denoted, because I think I saw some of those plats, and they had sheds and equipment and other things on airport property, which created a trespass issue. And there's a lot of elements I know we didn't get into and don't want to make it the specific point, but I think I contend that on a public engagement standpoint, there were multiple areas where there was public input and opportunity for it. And in fact, the commissioner worked through some protests given public input on those solicitations. So certainly there's always room for more public engagement, but I would give the examples where there was public engagement on specifically the action and on larger planning.
Thank you. Follow-up? Madam Co-Chair, thank you. Through the chair. So just for my own edification, tell me in-boundary versus out-of-boundary.
Through the co-chair to Representative Stutes, I mean that buffer zones outside of an airport boundary is a good conversation that we can have, and there's DOT regulations that speak specifically to the authority that DOT has in the aviation sense outside of an airport, because you're talking about clearance zones and whatnot. And in the case of Girdwood, and specifically the area that is at issue, sort of center issue for the legislation you're referring to, those homes had portions of in their backyard that were airport property. The boundary was actually in on their property, and it was, so they had elements of their personal effects and everything on airport property that were then part of the development that went to the airport boundary. And so I want to make sure when we're talking about public input what we're talking about as far as the actions that were taken, and that it was in airport boundary, and then there was the public engagement piece when those solicitations were sent out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that, because I think I am maybe mixing apples and oranges. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And just a quick comment. I showed up. I was prepared to hear the bill again and talk about it. And I'd reached out to Andy beforehand to ask these exact questions. And so it might be beneficial to send those documents that are public to the committee to demonstrate that, just as a comment, because mm-hmm. I asked that exact question.
Mr. Mills.
So through the co-chair to Representative Nelson, thank you. I did provide Mr. Nelson, Representative Nelson, a email with documents we had provided to Senator Geisel and Representative Holland, who had been engaged on this issue quite a bit. They certainly are engaged on it. And so I'm happy to share those with the rest of the committee if they lend you background that's beneficial.
Thank you. I'll just note we had intended to bring that bill back up today, and there are just scheduling difficulties, as I recall, talking with our committee aides and getting folks prepared for that. So okay. We will potentially bring that back up again. I'd like to get back on track with the presentation.
Sorry.
Representative McCabe, was your question? Okay. We'll set that whole conversation aside for another hearing. Back to Northern Region. please continue.
For the record, Lauren Little. So I just kind of wanted to highlight some standard bottlenecks and roadblocks, and then I've got a couple projects at the end to sort of highlight how efficient we can be when we don't have a lot of roadblocks and what happens, you know, what it kind of looks like when we have some of these roadblocks. And, you know, it's essentially the classic, there's things that are in our control and there's things that aren't in our control. Federal permitting agencies don't work for us. They're on their own time. They have their own missions. And so, you know, we've seen a real slowdown with the Corps of Engineers over the last couple of years. I think just throughout the state, we're seeing a lot of turnover in our regulatory agencies, a lot of new folks reviewing permits, reviewing information, catching up to speed. That's just kind of created these slowdowns. I did full disclosure. I was using ChatGPT to make these more graphic-y things, and they put 106 on there twice, and 404 permits on there twice, which I thought was kind of funny and fitting, because those two are areas where we have just really they just seem to kind of go on and on, and it's not that there's even really conflict necessarily. It's just getting through the process right away. If people don't want to sell their property, obviously, you know, there are paths forward that don't require their agreement, but they're not our preferred alternative, right? We want to work through that. We want to work through those issues, and that takes time. Representative St. Clair and I were talking about the Fairview Loop project, for example. That's one we're taking a lot of, you know, strips of front yards, and you know, that takes time. It takes respectful dialogue to get to understanding of the need and the impact and actually get that parcel secured. Utilities, this is another really common area, particularly post Buy America, Build America, where Congress, with the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, expanded the domestic preference for Federal Highway Administration projects that brought fiber optic cable under the domestic preference requirement. And also, at the same time, they removed what was the manufactured products exemption that we'd been operating under for a long time, that meant that things that kind of were a mishmash of things didn't have to fully comply. And so those combination of things really led to some challenges for utility companies. Utility companies are sitting there with rolls of material because they need to have materials on hand, going and finding certificates to comply with domestic preference for material on hand is very challenging. Many, you know, their suppliers being able to certify that. We saw some impacts. We had to kind of implement some things programmatically to start working, you know, giving us a path forward to the capital project delivery. You know, we're holding up a $40 million highway project for a utility relocation is tough to swallow. So we've been working through that process. But these are the things outside our control. And then, of course, there's resource constraints, right? We always have more needs than we have funding. Even just, you know, staffing shortages, both within the department and our consultants, you know, we're really seeing that there's gaps in resources to deliver these projects, to do the engineering for them. and the permitting. And then, of course, you know, changing stakeholder views. You have a project, Fairview is another great example, that's been around for a long time. The area continues to develop. New people move in. And we've got to sometimes revisit our proposed solutions and rework them based on how the area has changed. So all of those things contribute to projects taking a little more time or cost than maybe was identified at that needs planning stage of the game.
Great. We have a couple questions here. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. First, a comment. Wouldn't it be nice to have 404 primacy? Second one is...
Follow-up?
I vote no.
404 primacy would help a lot with that. You notice that even ChatGPT put 404 up there twice, indicating how much of an impediment it is to state developing our own resources and roads and transportation infrastructure. So my real question is, follow-up if you don't mind, the FAST 41 process, do you use that at all in your FAST 41 permitting with the federal government, or is that strictly for contractors? And I'm seeing a head shake. Do you know what it is? Okay. I can help with that.
Okay. That's news to me, too. I thought that was something that was across the board.
I would think the state would be using it, and that's right.
I had a question myself, which is, I see how a lot of these things could be labeled as bottlenecks or roadblocks, and how there's a function where DOT would have to do something in response. But the stakeholder input and community opposition, I'm not quite sure how widespread community opposition on a project actually leads to project changes. So I want to give maybe an example. The Chena Hot Springs roundabout was not, or GARS too. GARS is maybe a better example. It's for those who are not from Fairbanks, GARS is, the public does not generally love that intersection. They had a ton of opposition to it. I'm sure half those people are plenty satisfied now that it's actually in there, but there was certainly a lot of community opposition to it. And with that project or the Chena Hot Springs roundabout, maybe just a couple that are within Northern Region's wheelhouse, how does community opposition affect or change how a project is delivered or the scope of a project?
Yeah, to the co-chair. So obviously, you know, helping the public understand what we're doing and why is a key part of our jobs. And so that was a lot of the work. Both of those projects were Highway Safety Improvement Program projects. So those are fairly rigidly scoped. They have to meet certain cost-benefit criteria. So a lot of that, and actually one of our example projects later is a Highway Safety Improvement Program project. A lot of those projects is more of an educational piece of this is why roundabouts, you know, why it's the solution here, right? For Chena Hot Springs Road, it was the speed mitigation, right? A lot of what we were seeing out there was we had a nice, pretty black and white 45-mile-an-hour sign that nobody was complying with. A roundabout physically forces you to comply with that lower speed, manage those conflicting movements in that area. But I'll also give you some examples of times where we did fundamentally change what we were doing. The Old Nenana Highway project, that was originally scoped as essentially go make it black again. When we went to the community, we heard overwhelmingly from them that they really needed shoulders. There's a lot of non-motorized use out there, and it was really uncomfortable. So we actually did go through the process to kind of rescope that, modify our federal aid agreement, put the shoulders on that road. The 4 foot is sort of our standard for accommodating bikes and peds along a road like that. We did go ahead with the road widening and built that into the project. So it really depends on the project as to and the available funding as to what we can do. There may be a scenario where we say, you know, that really we have to go repave this road. That's what we can afford. And if we don't do that, here's the state M&O cost on that of not doing it. And the Highway Safety Improvement Program, again, we have to meet those cost-benefit criteria. We have to, those are fairly rigidly scoped projects. We need to stay within those bounds. So it goes both ways, but a lot of that public engagement, both for the Chinon Hot Springs Road Roundabout and the Gaffney Airport Rich Steves project, was that back and forth. How do we take, this is the crash pattern, this is the engineering solution, that we have national data to support, but are there adjustments we can make? So like some things we added to the Chinon Springs Road Roundabout was a high friction surface treatment. We heard from the community that they were concerned about the grades through there. So we built some things. We also established a little state funded piece for a bypass lane. That wasn't eligible for the HSIP component, but we were able to get that bypass lane in with a small state project to accommodate some of that feedback we've been hearing about people, heading out Chinon Hot Springs Road, feeling like, it was really inconvenient to have to come through that traffic circle, and bypass. So there's a lot of different ways we respond to that public engagement. It isn't always just completely changing the project. A lot of times it is some of these smaller adjustments, but we do also have instances where we go, you're right, community, this is what needs to happen out here, and we're going to adjust that design to accommodate it.
Yes, go ahead.
Through the chair, for the record, Al Beck. Just since she provided a great answer, and then on the far end of the bookend of that, an example earlier on in my career, probably over 20 years ago, we had a project in Fairbanks where the scope of the project was to extend a certain road, and it was going to require going onto some new land, and it was near a wildlife refuge. And even though we were skirting it and we were working with the public really closely to look at alternatives to provide that need, because it was in a long-range transportation plan to provide that connection, we heard from the public loud and clear they did not want it. And that would be an example where during the environmental process, we chose the no build and we closed down the project and we didn't build that. So that does happen, and that happened in my career, early on in my career.
And then I'll go to Mr. Mills, and then we have another question too.
Yeah, Andy Mills for the record. I'll make this brief, but I wanted to bring in, because those were good examples, an Anchorage example, which was the O'Malley to Diamond. That was moving forward, and there was sort of considerable concern from residents, and they brought up in the process, traffic or population, demographic changes, things they didn't like about Diverging Diamond and some of the way that traffic movements were occurring and what was. So there was every one of these, there's some good examples if we look for them on where the department has looked at public input and what is being raised. Not just that there is some opposition, but what it is that the public is saying. The roundabout here in Juneau, one of the first ones in Juneau that went in, was not popular before it was put in. And then once it's in, it's the best thing since sliced bread. And so the hardest part for anyone really, but at DOT, is to discern what is noise and what is signal, what is something we can change and still accomplish, or what is something we need to back off and take a completely different approach. And I know from a legislative context, many legislators do grapple, of course, with the same conundrum. You say on the floor, this is not popular, but we're doing this for the interest of the state or something else from a larger. So it's always, we're all struggling with that same, what is the serving the best good, and listening to folks when they raise concerns and how to do that.
Thank you. And I appreciate an example of a project that went forward despite opposition, a project that was changed in response to opposition, and a project that just didn't go forward in response to opposition. So I think that really gets at the heart of that question. And I would like to know more too at some point, not today probably, but at some point, about when we get community opposition at those later stages of a project, how that factors into the decision making versus the earlier stages of a project. Because at a certain point, if you've obtained the fund source from HSIP and you're constrained, there's only so much DOT can even do at that point. And if the project's already underway, then there's even less than you could do at that point in a lot of cases. So That's kind of a separate conversation, though. I'll go to Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, just two comments. First of all, I really appreciate the comment that Mr. Mills made, you know, trying to figure out what's happening. I am a big believer in the public process. I am a big believer in when folks make comments in favor or opposition of something to, especially if they're opposed, to suggest a alternative. I think that is really useful for anyone receiving the comment. What's a better way forward, and to make your case? So I appreciate that. The one thing I guess that I heard about some of the federal permits, and I heard U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and that process slowing down wetland field permits and turnover. I'm concerned about that, you know, until we change our laws. And by the way, many of these environmental laws have been here a long time, 1970, 1966. They're not new things. And as I look at the environmental permitting part, you know, I see Fish and Wildlife Service there, Army Corps of Engineers, EPA is involved. Each one has their own public comment process. So there's multiple opportunities for the public. But, you know, we talk often here about building in Alaska. Oftentimes I ask folks, you know, DOT, what's your vacancy rate? Because we know when you don't have a workforce, it's hard to deliver. And that also applies for our federal workforce. So I hope that we fill any vacancies there. I hope that those agencies can be made whole and do the work that they need to do so we can move forward as a state. And, you know, we talk about developing resources. Well, we have to get the permits to develop them, and we don't need 30 years to, you know, go from prospect to finish. So anyways, I appreciate the comments and the dialogue.
Thank you, Coach Eichheit. We'll go to Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I'm really curious on one specific project because I'm pretty certain it had almost 100% negative review, and that's that reverse double diamond two-step cha-cha over Muldoon and over the Glen Highway. How did is that worked out better? Do we have data that says that it's actually a good thing, or are we having old people confused, like me, old people confused when they go through there and getting in the wrong lane? And
Mr. Mills.
Andy Mills, for the record, through the co-chair to Representative McCabe. Thank you for this one. I believe that my other special assistant and the commissioner's office at DOT, Shannon McCarthy, would actually be excellent to answer this, as we've talked to her. She was there at the time. And my understanding, as I translate the time she's told me this, is, so one, any new turning movement that you're trying to teach the public is going to be awfully difficult. GARS is an example, diverging diamonds. But they may not be new for some jurisdictions down south where they've maybe had a little more time with them, if those folks have experience. But certainly in Alaska, I mean, a roundabout's not that new, and yet that is a new turning for some communities, certainly. On that particular location, my understanding was it was safety that was driving that particular implementation of a diverging diamond, and that it has been, my understanding, successful at addressing some of the safety concerns at that particular area. May not still be popular, but again, there's some for DOT. We are looking for a roundabout is not stopping accidents. It's changing the incident, the type of accident, to something less severe. And so, in many cases, the public may not love some of what we're implementing, but it ultimately may save lives or lower the threshold of certain types of incidents. And that's what we're also aiming for.
Thanks,
Representative Stoops.
Thank you. Co-chair, what is diverging diamond?
So if you're going to turn right, you go left. Eventually.
What?
Through the co-chair, Representative Stoots, it's very similar to what we call a tight diamond interchange. So if you have, essentially, you've got a signalized intersection on each side of an overpass. But in a diverging diamond situation, it's driven by the heavy left turning movement at those signalized intersections. you'll actually, what we do is we cross traffic over at the first signal. And what that essentially does is it takes, in a normal traffic signal, you have a four phase. Basically, everybody gets their turn, right? With the diverging diamond, we're able to, with that swap of traffic, to make those four-phase signals two-phase signals. And so it tremendously improves the operational capacity of those intersections. If you want to see a recent example, the Steese Johansen project has some great visualizations on the project website. That is a current proposal for Fairbanks, is to build a diverging diamond there where the Steese and Johansen expressways meet. So there's some great visualizations and drive-throughs and stuff on that if you want to learn more about the diverging diamond concept. But they are an exceptionally efficient way to move traffic, especially a location like that where you have very heavy truck traffic both on the Steese and the Johansen, and you're trying to manage that with also a very heavy commuter volume.
Follow-up? Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
You need to talk to me like I'm a third grader on this issue. And you use... So a diverging diamond, it sounds to me like it's a light that lets you turn in front of traffic coming this way. Is that right?
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutz, it's still essentially two traffic lights on either side of an overpass. It's just that the way we get traffic through them is much more efficient. It's not going to be something to explain in 2D. So I would really encourage you to check out that Steese Johansen project website because it does have, it's got maps, it's got visualizations. You can even kind of see it from car level, what it would be like going through that. So that's on the Northern Region Projects page.
Northern Region Steese Johansen?
Yep.
I just sent you a picture of Muldoon.
And my understanding is Muldoon's a little bit slightly different than what we're doing at Steese Johansen, but same basic traffic pattern.
I haven't got it yet. Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I see a lot of so I'm one of those people, I shouldn't even put this on the record because if Fairbanks people are watching, some might come after me. But I actually think once GARS was fully constructed, I get it now, that you have basically – instead of stopping at lights where there's heavy traffic and you've got highway traffic and inner city traffic, which is similar to the spot in Anchorage, it allows for traffic movement more continuously flowing. And I know the diamond situation is different, but woe betide your office when that proposal comes out more publicly in Fairbanks, because there's definitely a lot of pushback on GARS, and I can't even imagine the Steese Johansen intersection. Just, I sympathize. I empathize with what DOT is going to have to go through for that. And, Mr. Mills?
And for the record, Andy Mills, to the conversation at hand through the co-chair, my understanding also on GARS was also, it was largely what the project cost was in relation to some of the alternatives, which is one more factor we haven't really quite talked about. But if you have something that comes in quite a bit more and it's going to eat a much larger portion of the federal funds that we have, you may make some different choices that are also providing some other benefits. And I think GARS is an example on the original evaluation. I thought it was cost was a big piece of one of the alternative selections on that too.
Representative Mina?
Through the co-chair, just to comment, I love the diverging two-step cha-cha diamond, Representative McCabe. I think it's been great as a pedestrian and having to bike from Mountain View, trying to get to Ticotnu and then going through Muldoon, it's way safer. And there's a lot of high schools going through that area. It is very confusing as a driver at first, but to echo Co-Chair Carrick, once you start to drive through that area, it is a win-win for both pedestrians and drivers. So I appreciate DOT being responsive and attentive to a lot of the public push for wanting to see more of those types of pedestrian improvements. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mina. I just saw the picture of the Steese Johansen, and I stand by my earlier comments. I'm sure there's a lot of great value to it. I think Representative Mina just talked to it, but the public unfamiliarity with some of these projects makes it challenging. The GARS intersection, for those that aren't from Fairbanks, generated its own set of memes from the community. It's like very publicly commented on project.
You'd one of those on Razanoff in Upper Mill Bay, Mill Bay.
Yeah. You'd have about a 50-car pileup.
Anyway, ignore this. We can, we have a few more slides left. I think just in the interest of time, we can probably just walk through the rest of our slides and then we'll just hold questions till the end, if that's okay.
Absolutely. For the record, Lauren Little. So my understanding, one of the asks was kind of an understanding of what the regional project development structure looks like and how the work gets done. So this general structure is consistent across all of the regions. There's a regional pre-construction and a regional construction engineer. Under them are the names vary by region, but it's an engineer architect for position, and some we call them group chiefs, we call them section chiefs, we call them project delivery team leads. But fundamentally, they're a section chief that has a staff of managers and technical resources underneath them. And then over on the project delivery side, you'll have design and construction managers with assigned staff. And then we have these support functions like a regional right-of-way chief, a regional utility engineer, regional traffic and safety engineer, regional environmental manager, materials and geotechnical engineers, hydraulic engineers, some more focus groups that support the delivery. So the design and construction managers are responsible for managing that project development flow. These resources, the support section resources, are responsible for managing components of that. So the right-of-way chief is the person who certifies that the right-of-way is complete. We followed all the rules. That project can move to construction, utility engineer for the utility scope, traffic and safety engineer for things like work zone safety, traffic signal decisions, reviewing any traffic modeling that may have gone into determining what improvements need to be made. The regional environmental manager is responsible for signing all of the environmental documents for the region. And then the specialists, the geotechnical, hydraulic engineers, those guys are making recommendations on, you know, what your pavement section needs to be, how big your culvert needs to be, and doing some of those more technical detailed designs that feed into the overall project development process. And so I just wanted to highlight a couple projects. So this was a Highway Safety Improvement Program project in Fairbanks. These are both projects I managed, so that's why they got highlighted. But they also are a great, this one's a great example of a project that was delivered on time and actually under budget and, in fact, outperformed on the crash cost reduction than anticipated. And there's some reasons for this. This project, as I mentioned, Highway Safety Improvement Program, those are very detailed scope, right? They're not really open to scope creep. You're fixing a very specific problem with a very well-documented solution for that problem. And so in this case, it was adding a two-way left turn lane. We have a tremendous amount of driveways per mile on this road. It's a 55-mile-an-hour road. We also had these high friction surface treatments at a couple intersections that had been problematic. They just get a little bit slippery there in the winter, and all of these improvements. I did get the regional traffic and safety engineer updated me after this had gone to final. It was a 37% crash cost reduction, not a 40%. So just don't want to get hit later for providing correct data, but ultimately, you know, this project was very deliverable because it was well-defined. We have quite a bit of right-of-way existing on Badger Road. Somebody already went out and widened it and added a bike path and did those sorts of things. There's not a lot of utilities that were impacted with this fairly minor widening to accommodate the two-way left turn lane. And so a lot of the things were in our control, and that allowed us to march this thing right along and deliver it as planned. And then we have the Parks 319 to 325 reconstruction. And so this is a great example of a project that the need was clear, right? We call this, this one is affectionately referred to as Twisty Hilly. For anyone that's driven this stretch, this is the stretch between Fairbanks and Nenana, closer to the Nenana end. And you have this slalom that starts around mile 323. The worst of it's that 322 to 321 stretch. And we'd done multiple highway safety improvement projects in the in the area. We'd done curve delineation, speed feedback signs. It wasn't cutting it. And so it was really, we need to do a realignment. But obviously, something this size isn't going to fit a highway safety improvement program cost benefit just because of the sheer cost of the project, even though we've had multiple fatalities. Even since we started this project, I think we've had two or three fatalities in this stretch. And so, you know, it was sort of, we need the big fix. And a project like this, you don't really have a good handle on what it's going to take until you have that project start, that survey, those preliminary alignments. And we grappled with how much this was costing. And so we had some stakeholder engagement. We actually kind of formed a small technical advisory group that included a member of the Tocatilli group down there in Nenana that was also a truck driver. So he, you know, routinely drove this road as someone in a commercial vehicle. And ultimately said, okay, you know, it's this or nothing, right? This is, yes, it's expensive. But it took some time to get there and to get that buy-in for the sheer project cost. In the middle of all this, we went through a stage where we'd had some success with these corridor projects, these long corridor projects where you can really cost-effectively get survey, your environmental done, wetlands, cultural resource investigations. There's not anything really complicated about them, but by being long, we can get a real low engineering cost compared to construction cost. And then Federal Highways, they had some new interpretations around fiscal constraint and became much more rigid in how that needed to be reflected in our programs and our plans. And that caused us to have to revisit a lot of these corridor projects that, you know, we plan to build out over a long period of time. But with this fiscal constraint and at the time what we call the time trap rule, which is a 10-year rule that's no longer in place, but at the time all of those factors said, oh, we got to trim this project down to something a little bit more fundable. The original project was 305 to 325. This was also a really tough job to estimate. It had several million yards of excavation. As well as, you know, the final alignment and profile had areas where you were crossing the existing highway with 20 foot of new embankment. And so how do we manage traffic with all of that? How do we stage this material-wise efficiently? And so we ultimately did go construction manager, general contractor, delivery style for this. Granted, as the contractor, you see the construction pictures, some of the innovations they came up with, like that bridge crossing to reduce the amount of time we had to stop traffic on the Parks Highway, and they were able to work through. Had very smooth operations this last year, first year of construction on this. We're moving into the next year as well as adding the final piece of milepost range to this. But it took some time to get there because we did have, you know, we had some of those constraints. This is a great one to highlight the complexity of land ownership in our state. So this one, you have Tocatilli that owns the surface rights out here, and then Doyon owns the subsurface rights. So we have to actually acquire from two different entities for the same piece of property. And so all of that stuff, you know, kind of made this one, if you looked at what we thought it was going to be at that needs planning stage, project start, to what it ended up, you know, schedule, cost, none of those things were met. So just wanted to highlight kind of two very different projects, but both, I think, really important investments and improvements to our infrastructure.
Great. And that sounds like that was our last slide, too. So we can just take some questions on this slide or general questions at this time, and we'll go to Representative Stutz and then McCabe.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm just curious. I mean, it's interesting to see this last slide. How much should a project like that end up costing? Ballpark it.
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutz, it's about $100 million.
Wow. Thank you.
It's an immense project. When you drove through it this summer, it was just, it's crazy how long this problem has existed, this area of highway. It's in my district, but it's also just a really well-known stretch of road. You get people coming up from Anchorage. This is hour 6.5 of your 7-hour drive to Fairbanks. People are tired. People are not driving safely anymore. Mm. and we just have a lot of fatalities and accidents. So this project is really transformational for the area.
May I have a follow-up,
Madam Chair? Yeah, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Appreciate it. Through the Chair, have you noticed a decrease in fatalities on this road since the project?
Through the Co-Chair of Prism Institutes, we've only just begun constructing. We have not transitioned traffic over to the new alignment. So it'll be a couple more years.
Thank you.
You can just see it. It's just cutting right through the mountain, through the domes. Representative McCabe.
Yeah, thanks. So I've driven that a couple times when Ashley let me go through her district. And I have actually thought coming up on it. The first time I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be a mess. But it's actually like with that bridge there, I thought that some of the solutions that your contractor came up with were pretty elegant for the big mess that it really could have been. Almost like the zipper thing that the DOT bought for the Glen bridges. Mm-hmm. That was amazing. I was driving on that when they were doing the zipper, and I thought, wow, why didn't we do this 20 years ago instead of trying to move barriers and all that kind of stuff? But my real question is, you talked a little bit about the subsurface rights and the surface rights, and I'm curious if DOT has an office or a project manager that disposes of now. So see the little where it says milepost 323 there? There's a little. So obviously that was your right-of-way before. What are you going to do with it now? Are you going to sell it? Or are you going to keep it? Is it go back to Doyon? Is it part of a trade? And I have a specific reason for asking this question. But, I mean, maybe you don't know. Maybe Andy knows. I don't know.
Yeah, through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, there's a lot of, this is the interstate highway system, so federal highways would be involved in any decisions to vacate. A lot of our interest on the Parks Highway is easement interest. I don't know about the details here. So at this time, I believe a lot of those areas were actually material disposal areas, so we still had significantly more cut than we needed fill, or it wasn't suitable to put in a road embankment. So a lot of those old right-of-ways were used to move that material. So I couldn't tell you the details at mile 323. We can certainly have the project manager look at that. There is a right-of-way disposal process that the state has available in the event there was somebody interested in that property.
Follow-up? Thanks, yeah. So the reason I'm asking is there is a number of right-of-ways, I understand, from real estate agents in the Valley that were bought by the DOT that are between Church Road and Big Lake Road that real estate agents are frothing at the mouth over, and they keep telling me that the DOT is resistant to selling them for one reason or another. And it could amount to millions of dollars, I think. At least that's what I'm told, and I'm wondering if there's a way that we can do that, a fast-track process. Maybe it's federal highways in that area. I don't know, but it seems to me we bought up a lot of right-of-ways for a 20-foot piece of property, and we could sell it and just have whoever the buyer is resurvey it so that it's all nice and legal. But anyways, that's my question. When are you going to sell?
Mr. Mills.
Andy Mills, for the record, through the co-chair to Representative McCabe. Correct. On that area of the parks, we did some substantial work over the last 10 years. And what generally happens with some of that additional right-of-way that is acquired is that they do plan on potential disposals. In fact, on the park section, when I inquired, they were looking at which parcels and what portions to dispose of. However, I know that there is this countervailing concern that if they dispose of something that still has a transportation need, so that's part of the calculus that our right-of-way team is working through. Of course, this is the same team that's working on all of our large projects, so disposal is perhaps, I would say it nicely, saying not the highest priority when we're trying to work with our teams to get additional projects out the door. But that is a function that they do intend to take on those. It's a question of when, not if. But the calculus there is really, is there an ongoing or future transportation need that we would need to hold on to some portion of it? Because heaven forbid you dispose of it and then you run through another acquisition on something that was placed there.
Fair point. Thanks.
Okay. Do we have any additional questions for our presenters? Seeing none, I really want to thank Lauren Little, who is both acting Northern Region Director, which is a huge job in and of itself, and Chief Engineer. It's just been really great to have you in that position for Northern Region. And I'd also want to thank our pre-construction engineer, Al Beck, for coming. This is a side of the internal components of DOT that I don't think I've seen a transportation committee like deep dive into. And I just wanted to offer to committee members, if there's other components of how DOT's processes work, we have all these great in-house experts, and we'd be happy to bring another section or division in. Representative Nelson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I apologize, but your comment prompted me, and I keep going back to it, with the new structure plan. I was wondering if where this department would fall in the new from principles to structure. I mean, I've asked it of everybody else here, and I just have forgotten on this one. Does that make sense on the flow chart that we've gone over before?
And at this point, this is going to be a question for Mr. Mills, I believe, because this is related to the departmental restructure.
Yeah. Thank you for your indulgence.
Again, Andy Mills for the record, and through the co-chair to Representative Nelson. So I think Director Little or myself actually can both sort of answer this one on the FY27 structure changes. So Northern Region for some time, again, this is actually one of those things I remember early on when Commissioner Anderson was Regional Director Anderson, that Northern Region was pioneering some of these teams that were bringing folks together. And we were working, in fact, again, illustrating this point, Director Little is working on the Fairview Loop project, as we were talking about when we first came in, which is a project down in the Mat-Su and not in Northern Region. And so as envisioned in the restructure, there are teams, cross-regional teams, and you have a functional director who is going to be assisting with all those teams that still have, again, regional staff that are working in construction or M&O, depending on the area we're talking about. And so you're still very much going to have the regional structure and regional representation, but you're going to have this unifying functional lead that's going to assist with, again, how you're having commonality and parity across the state. And so from the structure that's up here, and I might see if Director Little has anything else to add, but we've been doing this in Northern Region and trying to do more of this through the regions, and it's envisioned to carry forward with doing this as a way of common practice.
Yeah, for the record, Lauren Little, through the co-chair to Representative Nelson, this chart is common to all three regions today, and it doesn't change in the restructure. The realignment that we're doing simply is right now pre-construction and construction engineers report to a regional director. In the modified organization, they will report to an infrastructure director. So they'll have one director over infrastructure as opposed to three regional directors. And then the maintenance and operations side of the regional resources, they'll still be regional chiefs reporting to an M&O director. And what this is, what that's formalizing is exactly what Mr. Mills talked about, this cross-regional support. So Mr. Beck, Mr. Boland, Mr. Miller, the three regional pre-construction engineers, they get together with me and with my other hat on, my chief engineer hat, and we make sure we're all tackling the big picture problems, the roadblocks to project delivery, supporting each other with resources. Same on the construction side. The three regional construction engineers and myself get together regularly. We've got Northern Region staff supporting projects, I believe, in Ketchikan this summer in construction. It's simply aligning under a common director more than anything. The regional structures stay the same, and the work that we've already done to support each other as an organization is simply being formalized under a single director.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great question, Representative Nelson. At this time, there's nothing else before our committee today. Our next hearing will be next Tuesday, March 24th at 1 p.m. At that hearing, we're hearing about DOT's Office of Civil Rights, which is also sort of a unique little aside, deep dive into some of the internal work of DOT. We will also at that hearing have a first hearing on a bill from Representative Holland related to fire areas and rights of way. And then we will continue some discussion on the autonomous vehicles legislation. And then I just want to give committee members a heads up. Next Thursday, you'll see that we do not have a meeting noticed. However, there will very likely, pending a couple, oh, we're good to go. There will be an invite forthcoming. Very excited to tell you all, for a field trip next Thursday afternoon at our regular committee time to go watch an avalanche demolition or an avalanche. So we're going to be doing that, and if Mr. Mills wants to add to that, we're really excited about it. The Senate Transportation Committee will be coming. It's an exclusive invite for just the Transportation Committee, so would highly encourage folks to join us. Okay, great. With nothing else before the committee, we are adjourned at 2:24 p.m.